This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1026, A Conversation with Mike Carlin. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. This is episode 1026. It's a conversation with Mike Carlin, or rather, it's the second conversation with Mike Carlin. I've actually already had the good fortune to speak with Mike Carlin already recently in the last 6 months. But this is a new conversation, and specifically in this conversation, we do talk about Marvel versus DC, or DC versus Marvel, depending on how you like to name it, because it's technically both, and then also about the Amalgam comics, both Wave 1 and Wave 2. So we kind of do a deep dive into those. I've always been fascinated with that period. I would have been, 95, I would have been 11 or 12, and so I guess the first one came out after Ben Reilly was already Spider-Man, so that would have been, 96. So, you know, I was, 13 years old, or actually not even, I was 12 years old reading these comics. I remember picking up DC versus Marvel number 3. I think that's the only issue I had for many, many years. But a lot of the big, battles actually happened in that issue, so I always enjoyed it. I had a few of the original Amalgam books. If I have to think about it, I think JLX was definitely one of the ones I was able to get my hands on when I was younger. I don't know which other ones. Eventually, I kind of acquired them all. I think I'm only missing one at this point, and it's from the second wave. It would be the Adventures of Dark Claw, the Dark Claw Adventures, the one that was patterned after the Batman the Animated Series style, which was an interesting choice, a very fun one to do. Anyway, so we do a deep dive, and we talk about what it was like to work on these books, what it was like to work with Mike Carlin. Sorry, not with Mike Carlin, with Mark Gruenwald, I should say, because I'm speaking to Mike Carlin. And obviously, check out the previous interview that I did with Mike Carlin, which was back in episode 1005, so 21 episodes ago, back from September 2023. That's a little bit more of your standard kind of career-spanning interview. This one, as I said, we go a lot more in-depth on a specific period, which meant a lot to me and is something I always really enjoyed and thought was a lot of fun to read. And so it was nice to kind of talk to him about it. I actually do reference here speaking with Tom Brevoort, because Tom Brevoort and I recently had a conversation, and we ended up talking about that kind of period and what it was like to work on the Marvel vs. DC stuff. Now, if you want to check those Tom Brevoort interviews, you can check out episode 1015 as well as episode 1020. We did a deep dive into the 90s. So obviously, in terms of the 90s books that Tom was involved with, that was definitely included the Amalgam books as well as Marvel versus DC. So that's kind of getting more of a Marvel perspective on it, but obviously Mike Carlin was the main guy in control of the crossover from the DC side. Marvel side, it was obviously Mark Gruenwald, who had passed away, I think it was in 96, so it's been quite some time, but he was the Marvel kind of liaison working on this specific project. Anyways, we do reference some of Tom's comments in this interview as well, so just for some other context and background, you might want to check that interview out as well. It's also just great to hear Tom Brevoort talk about the 90s comics. So without further ado, I'm about to throw it to myself, interviewing Mike Carlin and talking about these books. But first, you can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and also listen to us on Spotify. Upcoming episodes are exciting. We are going to have Michael Urie at some point. It may not actually come out till March, but I just had the interview the other day. He's the editor-in-chief, or just editor of Back Issue Magazine for Tomorrow's Publishing. He also wrote a superhero team-up companion, which was a really exciting book, and we talk about that at length as well. Other upcoming episodes include Glenn Greenberg coming back to the show to talk about Star Trek Untold Voyages, which is a miniseries he did in the late 90s when Marvel had the Star Trek license. We also have hopefully a new episode with Mark Bagley. I'm supposed to be recording that in a couple days, so hopefully that's another exciting episode with Mark Bagley talking about his career in comics. We have a Book of the Month Club for February. It's probably going to come out late February as we talk about basically three different Spider-Man storylines. We talk about Life Theft, Pursuit and Shrieking. We haven't actually recorded it yet, but hopefully it'll come out on time and I won't need to press my wife into service like I did for episode 1025, where we did a kind of spur of the moment Book of the Month Club on Pedro and Me. Anyways, thanks for listening to this very long intro, and let's jump right into the conversation as I speak with Mike Carlin. Mike Carlin. Enjoy. Mike, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
So far, so good.
So I have you back for a very specific reason this time. I know that we talked last time about how we would talk eventually about specific Superman books during your tenure. But what I'm really curious about, and especially as I do more interviews with people who are working in and around comics at the time, one thing that always stood out for me as a younger reader was the DC versus Marvel Comics or Marvel versus DC event. And obviously you were one of the co-editors of that event. So before I ask you about the origins of the event, I think I have to ask you, what is your origin of your, when did you first meet Mark Gruenwald? Because obviously he's a pretty big factor in this production.
It was definitely a big factor that we were friends. Writing and drawing for Crazy Magazine at Marvel, which was the humorous stuff, so it wasn't necessarily the superhero stuff. But by being up in the office, the editor of Crazy knew that I was into comics, and he asked me if I wanted to be an assistant editor. When Mark Gruenwald got promoted, I interviewed for that job because I was like, sure, I'll be an assistant editor, whatever that is. And Mark... someone talked him into it or paid him off or whatever. and I became instantaneously best friends with him. He was my best man at my wedding, and, I was in his wedding, and we were tight. Mm-hmm. We were tight. It was really a match made in Hades. You couldn't say hell in Marvel. But it was really just, he was my friend. Mm-hmm. And then I did get fired at Marvel, not by Mark, and he actually was very sad when I got fired. But I went to DC, and then obviously a few years later, while we were both at Marvel and DC, the opportunity to do this crossover came up, and it was perfect.
So I'm very curious, because obviously during, when I was speaking with Tom Brevoort recently, I was asking him, what was it like working on, this and the Amalgam books? And he was like, well, at the time, it just kind of felt like the next one, because obviously there was a lot of crossovers that DC and Marvel was doing at the time. So what was your interpretation of that? Like, did it feel like just the next one, or did this one feel different?
It felt different for me. Obviously, I was in the thick of it. The way it started was that... DC's vice president, Paul Levitz, and Marvel's president at the time, Terry Stewart, were at some kind of a shindig together. And the comic business had just come out of, the early 90s, where things were really booming. And they were starting to not be booming anymore. And they just basically said, we need to do something together to kind of kick the comic book business in the ass and see if we can wake everybody up. And they basically knew that Mark and I were friends, and they just asked me and Mark to get together and cook up something that was special. Now, I think it was something special, probably partly because it was me getting to work with Mark again after 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that was a great thing for me. I mean, we were still in touch, we would still go to the movies, we'd still have dinners, but actually working on our superhero comics together was the greatest. It really was something special. And it was the task of making it a little more important in terms of trying to help the companies do a little better. Mm-hmm. I don't know in the end if it was that successful. I mean, I don't know if it was, it certainly wasn't a Death of Superman level thing. And it was certainly not a, even, like the whole Image Comics and Death of Superman and mm-hmm. and all of that stuff kind of was so big that there was no way to recreate that. But we definitely drew some attention and got some interest back in the comics. And again, like Tom says, there were so many of the crossovers happening at that time that we needed to make it bigger than just Batman meets Wolverine.
Now, when you and Mark start collaborating on it, I'm curious, like, what kind of rules are put forth when working on something like this? Because the other crossovers were generally characters meeting up and going up against a villain, but now you're actually going to have DC characters versus Marvel characters. It's right in the title, right? So what kind of shenanigans, for lack of a better term, were had to try and figure out, well, how is this going to play fair for everyone? And obviously no one's going to be happy with everything, but what was that process like of trying to figure out how to actually make this work so that both companies will be happy?
That was the thing. It actually started out with even apart from the characters, first we decided to say which of the DC writers and the DC pencilers are the most prolific DC guys who really stay DC at this time in our career, mm-hmm. and which are the guys who say Marvel, you know, so, and the fact that they had mostly, and maybe even done both work at both companies, that's even better. Mm-hmm. Well, so Marvel picked Peter David to be their writer, and we picked Ron Morris, who's kind of an up-and-coming guy for us, at DC, but we also put Dan Jurgens on as the penciler, who had already done Death of Superman and even Zero Hour, I think, might have happened before this, too.
Yeah, I think so.
So he was kind of our big gun in the crossover department. And then Marvel brought their newcomer, which was Claudio Castellini, who was a great artist, and he brought something fresh to the table that was not really a known quantity, as far as I was concerned. So we just decided on the team first, and then Mark Grunewald and I and Peter David and Ron Mars went to Mark's apartment in Manhattan, and we locked ourselves into his place, and we sat there for a day and just tried to have fun. And we did. We had a lot of fun. And the most fun was when we came up with the idea of, right before the series ends, melding characters so that they become amalgamated. And that we couldn't, because we weren't laughing. We were just enjoying the possibilities of what that could be. So we didn't come up with that part of the story yet. You know, the rest of the story we worked out while we were there that day, you know, who the big bad guys were going to be and who the main heroes were going to be. And then the idea of people voting on the outcomes of big fights at the end would be a big part of it as well. So we came up with all that stuff in one day.
Wow, that's quite the day.
Well, it was a great day. It really was. It was really a lot of fun. But then the trick was we had to go and sell it to the bosses.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, the bosses were the guys who came up with the idea of us having to do something. And I think that they were very happy with the level of stuff we came up with, because it really was unprecedented. You know, I mean, having the fans involved was one thing. That was a great thing. I mean, we had done the vote for whether Robin lives or dies one time. But the whole idea of it wasn't just a crossover. It was now the characters were going to become each other. And it was something that had never been done. It's something that would be hard to do a lot of. And it was just great. And we didn't come up with the actual amalgam that day. What we did was Mark went back to the Marvel editors and I went back to the DC editors and I said, here's what we're going to do. Everybody suggests amalgamated characters. So everybody was giving me all kinds of lists of crazy, you know, comments. And it was just, it was amazing. It really was amazing. It was just a big creative thing, and everybody got into it. And we really worked hard on trying to make it fun for everybody, including the readers.
I'm curious, so, you know, in that day of brainstorming, like, you come up with the idea of, you know, putting these characters together, how quickly does it become like a mini event almost on its own that you're going to release, what was it, 8 or 10 books that were going to be kind of cross-published as Amalgam Comics? Like, did that kind of come later after the initial idea of, well, let's see if we can meld these characters together at the end of this series, or was that kind of baked in from the premise as well?
No, that was baked in pretty much. It was a thing. There's still a thing. There's every now and then there's a month on the calendar where there's 5 weeks in the month, mm-hmm. and five comic book shipping day week. So if the comics came out on Wednesday, it happened to be a month that had five. So you had your regular 4 weeks that comics would come out. So there would be a Superman, there'd be a Man of Steel, there'd be Action Comics, and there'd be, you know, Adventures of Superman, and then it was dead week. So we said, let's build a dead week with mishmash. and we came up with the idea that it would be this whole separate company and that there would be an editor-in-chief who was me and Mark together. And it was just like, it just became a whole separate thing. It wasn't Marvel Comics. It wasn't DC Comics. The Amalgam logo was a blend of both companies' logos. And it really just was, again, fun. We were making up something that had not existed the day before. And it was all, you know, we didn't figure out the logo, but we came up with all that stuff. In fact, I don't think it was actually called Amalgam Comics that day. At the beginning, it had something, like, we called it something like, the whole job was going to be called Rivalry or Rivals or something like that.
Yeah, I think Tom said the same thing. I think he said it was called Rivals.
Yeah, and then, you know, for some reason, I guess there was a company called Rival Comics, a small company at the time, and we just said, oh, we shouldn't do that. We should make up something that's our own. Unfortunately, we came up with Amalgam, and I say unfortunately because many fans to this day and even retailers called it Amalgam Comics.
Oh my God!
we were a little surprised too.
I had never heard of that before, and that's shocking to me.
We heard it a lot, and they were shocking, and now it's not. Now it's just part of the story.
With all the Amalgam books, were you and Mark like overseeing the different Amalgam books? I mean, I don't think you're credited on the books themselves, or was that just in each individual editor taking care of it, or were you kind of the super editor, so to speak?
We oversaw the whole project, but at the same time, we didn't nitpick the individual Amalgam issues. You know, we had the editors do that. You know, editors who, you know, whoever suggested Dr. Strange Fate or whatever, they would be the editor of that comic or whatever, so we had enough, we spread the wealth around a lot, and I guess we had veto power over which talent they wanted to put on the projects and stuff like that, but again, we weren't like stern taskmasters as far as that was concerned. Unless you talk to them and you may hear otherwise that we ruined some great bad somewhere.
I'm curious as well, you
know, like, and then for me and Mark, we stuck to the main story. We stuck with the, and so the same with the writers, Dan Jurgens, Ron Mars and Peter David, Dan Jurgens and Claudio, they stuck to the main four issues of the actual big crossover, but they were not as involved in any of the other stuff that came along, for the Amalgam books.
I'm curious for the Amalgam books, how it was decided which books would be kind of published by either publisher, because that's an interesting kind of moment when some of them end up on the Marvel side, theoretically, and some on the DC side. And then you see that in later trade paperback publications where DC reprints like theirs and Marvel reprints theirs. So I'm very curious how that delineation kind of bore out.
Well, most of it was just like, if your company thought of the Amalgam, then you got the first choice to do it. And that was basically how it was. It was no real big master plan or fighting over who got what characters or whatever. So it worked out pretty evenly as far as I remember. Ultimately, you know, we really used pretty much all of the good ideas for amalgamations. The only one we didn't use that I regret to this day was Alfred Jarvis, giant-sized manservant.
Well, that's funny. I like that.
That would have been a great one. And maybe someday, if they ever want to collect it, we could add a little 22-page special new edition. But I don't know. I think the days are gone for that crossover in particular.
So I'm curious, like, I think it's a year or so later, you know, you have the second wave of Amalgam Books. Were you involved in that second wave?
Yeah, we were both involved in that. We came up with the idea of the character that would be shared between Marvel and DC, and that was the character Access, mm-hmm. who was a guy who was between the universes, and he had a miniseries that year. And then on the fifth week, the Amalgam Books happened that year. There was an idea, and I'm not so sure which characters were involved, but maybe Ron Mars or the other guys would remember. We even talked about having a character from each universe get stuck in their opposite universe for a year,
mm-hmm.
so that Marvel could use, say, Martian Manhunter, and we could use She-Hulk for a year. Only green people were part of this discussion. But I think the bigger wigs at both companies were just like, well, it's already going to be tough enough to co-own Access. Let's not co-own a year's worth of comic book stories. That's too much. We're back to being rivals again. We're not amalgams.
When the second wave comes out, which is in 97, so obviously, unfortunately, that would have been after Mark had passed. What was it like working on that project, I guess, without him?
Well, it had started before he passed.
Okay.
You know, it was going to happen with him involved, obviously. And that was the first time I got involved with working with Tom Brevoort, and Tom kind of took it over. And Tom is a perfect guy for this because he's a knowledgeable guy on both companies. He knows his DC stuff as well as anybody out in the world, and he's the guy who's lasted the longest at Marvel out of anybody. So he and I had that in common because I lasted pretty long at DC, and I'm not there right now, but I had my good run,
mm-hmm.
37. But then Tom is kind of coming up on stuff like that himself. So he was a good fit for that. And so there was no real difference. Obviously, I was I was disheartened that Mark wasn't involved in stuff because mm-hmm. he was always fun to deal with.
For sure. Now, going back.
I liked when we.
Sorry, go ahead.
Did the trade paperbacks and the collected it. We did a note from the publisher of Amalgam Comics, and that was M.M. Carmel. And we had a picture of me and Mark from when I worked at Marvel where we were sharing a sweater, and we were literally two-headed monster, and that was the picture of the editor. And then other collection, Mark had paid somebody to do a Photoshop montage of both of our faces, and we basically said that was M.M. Carwald after the operation. So we had a lot of fun with it, you know. That was the Stan Lee of that universe. He was an amalgam who was a two-headed man who turned into a guy with one face that was nobody's face but both of our faces. It was a lot of fun.
A stylistic question I have about the Amalgam books, because it is something that carried out amongst every book, so I'm imagining that kind of came from you guys, from you and Mark, but you had, every issue had, as was the style at the time, lots of footnotes, but obviously they're made up for stories that didn't happen. So as a kid, I was maybe 12 or 13 years old, just getting into comics, did not know that this was a fake company. So I remember when I first got them being like, oh man, there's like this whole universe, and then realizing afterwards, no, that's kind of the joke. It's not. But I'm curious whose idea it was to really flesh it out and make it feel really like it was a lived-in world.
I guess it was just that was, you know, a routine part of for doing comics back then was doing the footnotes. I mean, they're not there so much anymore.
No.
Partly because you can look on the internet 2 seconds and find out things that you want. And I encouraged, by the time we got to the 2000s, I was encouraging people to put footnotes that steered them towards collected editions.
Because
then they would get what story they needed, and also some more stuff that they might end up liking.
Mm.
And we get a little more money, so that was always good too. Ultimately, you know, the footnotes just kind of faded away, same as letter columns, because the internet, it kind of does that job. It doesn't, those were kind of archaic things, but at the time it was part of the fun to make up a fake history for this whole company. I do apologize for you wasting your time looking for comics.
I don't know if I looked for them, but I was just more like, oh, there's a new company, and then I just never saw them anymore. And then I was like, oh, that makes sense. I did figure it out pretty quick, but I remember, but when I first saw them, I'm like, oh, this is really exciting. This is cool. And then I realized, oh, that's why they look like the characters I know.
I'm not sure if we even changed the indices. I mean, I guess, did we say Amalgam was its own company, or did we say Marvel and DC and the indices?
You know,
which is the legal thing.
That's a good point. In the indicia, it does say published by Marvel Comics, published by DC. But if I was 11 or 12, I wasn't really looking for the indicia.
Yeah, I never. To this day, indicia. I didn't read them when I worked there, when I was supposed to be reading.
So I'm curious too. Like, so you take care of this, you know, these fifth week events and the Marvel versus DC crossover itself. But at the same time, you're still a Superman group editor. So what was like kind of spinning all those plates?
Oh, it was my job. You know, I got paid to do it. So it was just seemed normal to me. Again, it was like anything that made the job fun and not tedious and not, you know, the way I looked at it was it made my job different every day.
Mm.
You know, it was like, yes, I'm doing the same thing. I'm reading a plot, or I'm balloon placing the script, or just proofreading a story, whatever. But it was always a different story. It was always a different thing, and it was always a different goal, and that made it interesting. So, and it really made time go pretty fast. I mean, I know this is going to sound corny, but you know, now that I'm out of DC and retired from there, it's like. And I was 5 years at the Marvel, too, so it was like, I did over 40 years of this stuff, and it was just like, and now all of a sudden, it's 30 years ago, mm-hmm. You know? And it's, like, it's crazy to me. It's just crazy. And I took my responsibilities very seriously. I think Mark did, too, and I think Tom does now still.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were the guys who got our books out on time, generally speaking, and we were very serious about the job part of the job, but we also were pretty insistent on making sure it was fun and as innovative as we could make it.
For sure. So I'm curious. So when you're working on the Amalgam books, did you have a specific like pet favorite or like a title that you really enjoyed or you were particularly happy with the Amalgams that they came up with?
Well, I liked a lot of the Amalgams. I off the top of my head, I mentioned Dr. Strange Fate already.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason I liked that was because I thought the art was unbelievable. It was like with DC's Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, but inked by Kevin Nolan. Mm-hmm. And it was just a gorgeous, beautiful comic book. You couldn't really have put together a nicer comic. And it was just great. And that kind of stuff is what stuck with me. I like that we did, what was the Batman Wolverine combo guy? What was his name?
Dark Claw. Yeah.
Yeah. Second time we did a Dark Claw comic, we made it the Animated Adventures style.
That's right.
And that was fun too, because that was a whole different parody or tribute or fromage, whatever you want to call it. so that was fun to me to do that kind of stuff as well. You know, but again, we got so many great people involved in these things. John Byrne got to do Storm again, kind of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dave Gibbons worked on the Super Soldier comic. And it's just like, we got a pretty big deal guys involved in these projects. And,
absolutely.
It really was just everybody kind of wanted to play. And because it was a thing that they never thought was going to happen. Now, who would have thought of this? Even while we were thinking of it, we were like, well, who would think of this? Just three guys, four guys in a room in uptown Manhattan.
One I've always been interested in, so you bring up Dark Claw, which is definitely one of the most arresting visually, and you had that initial one-shot was written by Larry Hama. I'm curious, I mean, obviously Denny was the actual editor of the book, but what was the process of getting Larry to write that? Because, you know, he doesn't always love superhero comics, but he did an amazing job on that amalgam.
Well, I mean, Denny and I both worked with Larry at Marvel, so we all knew each other. Larry is actually the guy who hired me at Crazy Magazine and was the guy who suggested that I interview with Mark Gruenwald.
Oh, really?
So I was happy to have him involved in it any way he could be. And he was definitely, you know, I think he was writing Wolverine at the time.
Yeah, he had been writing Wolverine, but I know that he's gone on record as not being the biggest fan of superhero comics, even though he's written some amazing ones.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a fan of them to know how to do a good one. I'm just glad he also wanted to play along. I mean, he got the joke, and he went full head to steam right into it. And Denny, you know, again, Denny and Larry and I, we were all editors at Marvel at the same time. So we were, you know, part of this club. So it was kind of like a no-brainer.
You bring up John Byrne on Amazon, and that is an interesting one because obviously at the time, you know, John hadn't done Marvel work in a while, and now you have a character that looks very much like, you know, it's Storm, but not, as you kind of mentioned. So was that an easy process to kind of get him to buy in on it and to have fun and play in the sandbox?
Was he currently doing Wonder Woman at the time?
I'm trying to remember. I don't know if he was still working on it that late, but I could be wrong.
I just don't remember the exact timing, but I think he was doing Wonder Woman around then. So it was just logical that he would do Wonder Woman, and obviously if we're going to blend Wonder Woman with Storm, he should be involved because he's the big X-Men guy. So some of this is just so logical and by the numbers that we could not try for it. And again, the fact that people wanted to join in, a part of it was that the amalgam issues themselves, they weren't really a crossover. You didn't have to join into a bigger story. You just got to do your one story in 22 pages. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to the other books. You didn't have to mention a big crossover. You didn't have to do anything except make a fun one-shot about the Amazon. And that was appealing to people. You know, it was a crossover that wasn't a crossover. It was a little weird that way.
Yeah, it's more thematic, kind of, but it's just, yeah, more tales from this world. One that I guess didn't make it in the first cut, or maybe didn't come up with it at the time, but made it into the second wave that I'm curious about, just because it feels like one of those ones, as you said, that the name's just there for the taking, was Batthing, which was a great combination of a character, which, again, was incidentally done by Larry Hama. Was that when you had that character idea or that amalgam kind of put out to you, where you were like, well, of course, that makes sense.
What was the name of the character?
Batthing.
Oh. we couldn't get to all of them. We got to most of them. And the fact that we got to do a second wave of these a year later, it opened the door to do some new ones, you know. So it just was like, that was as good a name. Why shouldn't we do this one? And so that, obviously that came from the editors or Larry himself. I don't remember, actually.
It's definitely one of those, again, when I remember seeing that, I'm like, well, that is a great name for an amalgam character. Kind of like, as you said, Dr. Strange Fate or even Dr. Doomsday. Like, these names that seem to make a lot of sense. Maybe not the characters right. themselves in some ways, but in terms of the names, they just, you know, they just fit.
Yeah, I actually think Dr. Strange Fate is an awkward and clunky name, but Dr. Doom.
You're not wrong. I guess another clever name one was Therion, which was a nice combination as well.
That was good too, yeah.
There was a lot of fun stuff there.
It really was. And I know that the collected editions are out there somewhere, but they've been out of print for a lot of years. So everybody, you know, cross your fingers and see if the companies can play nice to each other. I don't know, you know, I think the days of doing those kind of crossovers, certainly that many of them, are kind of over, partly because it's now not just Marvel versus DC. Now it's Disney versus Warner Brothers. And you start getting to a level where, you know, people don't want to help out the other companies. They don't want to do that kind of stuff. Except that when business is in trouble, maybe it's worth it. So who knows? You know, I never say never, but I would love to see this kind of thing happen again. I would love to see whatever the next generation thought was a funny idea. This character into existence after we did this. You know, Harley Quinn is not a part of any of this stuff.
No.
And Damian Robin would be a great character to put in the midst of this stuff, too. And it's like, we got a couple of characters that came along later that would have been just really personality fun for this kind of mix-up.
Absolutely, that's true. It's interesting you mentioned the idea that, you know, the company's kind of playing nice if it means that they can make money. And I remember, you know, it was a year or two ago, and that was the it was in all the kind of comic press about they were re-releasing the JLA Avengers crossover because George was obviously ill at the time, and so they were bringing it back, but it was in such limited quantities, and everyone's like, well, why not more? And it seemed to be, well, because legally, like, the legal teams, this was the only amount they were comfortable with, and I think it was like, what, a couple thousand? Like, it wasn't very many, but that was a book that you would think would be an easy sell for both companies. So if they couldn't make that work, and especially for George before he passed away, unfortunately, it doesn't give me a lot of faith that they could ever do more amalgams or anything like that.
Well, that was kind of a just a doing a solid for an old friend. You know, that was we wanted to have it and see it before he died. And I'm not really personally sure why there was a limitation on it, but there was an element of a charity involved too. So I don't know what the rules or limitations are on that kind of stuff. So, you know, it wasn't like all the money was going to come to Marvel and DC anyway. We weren't doing it for the money. We were doing it only for George. And to us, it almost didn't matter how many there were. It did matter the fact that they were disappointed customers. So that, I think that was a mistake. But you know, you never know. You just never know. I don't know what the behind-the-scenes negotiations to get that to happen even were.
For sure.
And they happened pretty fast. And being the editor on that book, I was also happy that it was back in print for whatever reason.
So, I got to ask, what was it like working on that book? Because that book is monumental. Like, it is, which is, I guess, more surprising, not surprising, more of a tragedy that it hasn't been reprinted more, because it's very much like a very good evergreen story with amazing art. It's just a tour de force, and it's just the whole thing is such a thrill. Like, what was it like working on it?
Yeah, it's just it becomes tougher and tougher to get the companies to agree on whatever the deals are. And again, I think part of that is because, you know, there's not a lot of guys that like me and Grunewald at each company anymore who have known each other and are friends and socialize and all that kind of stuff. There's obviously less socializing going on now that DC's on the West Coast and Marvel's on the East Coast. You know, so there was a, seemed to be a lot more back and forth back then, back in the old days, and crisscrossing of talent, and me and Benny, and even Marvin George leaving Marvel to come to DC, and then going back to Marvel, and it was just like it was. People were all over the place back then, and nowadays it's some corporations that they're guys that don't even know what they have when they have a Marvel or a DC, let alone if they don't know who they have, you know. And it's a tough situation. It's just tough to get over, as far as, you know, when you get the lawyers involved, then it's just like, well, this isn't even creative anymore.
True. So I want to go back to DC versus Marvel for a second. So, you know, at what point in the process, as you mentioned, like on that first day, you already had kind of come up with the idea of a fan vote, which would lead to fan engagement, which is really a great idea. When or how quickly was it decided on what the matchups would be that the fans would have to vote on, and which ones were like not really up for debate, but which ones were more of a question of what the fans would vote for?
Well, we needed to do an odd number of combos so that there could be a winner, that a company could be a winner. And it was really just who were the most popular characters at the time. And it was totally based on that kind of a situation. These were the top characters at both companies. And in the long run, and I say this as a DC man who used to be a Marvel man, it was really just a popularity contest, in that the readers voted for anybody who was an X-Men because the X-Men are the most popular franchise in the last 30 or 40 years. So it just was like, you know, who did Wolverine go up against? Lobo?
Yeah, Lobo.
Yeah, I don't think Wolverine would win that fight. But that's just me. But I count myself as a Marvel guy and a DC guy, so I'm a company's man. But, and also Wonder Woman versus Storm. I don't think Storm would have won that contest.
No.
Personally.
I guess, yeah, as a kid, it was always like, wait, what? I love Storm, but...
But we agreed to the rules, and the readers voted, and that's what happened. So DC... I guess we technically lost that whole thing, but it was worth it. It was worth it.
When you mentioned access before, like, so how early in the discussion was it like that you guys were going to kind of co-own this new character that was being used for this book, and then again, as you said, kind of used in future, you know, miniseries? Because I think Access had two of them. But what was it like, the process of actually determining what this character was going to be like?
Well, that wasn't part of the first wave of Marvel versus DC. We didn't think of that then.
No.
So that came along later, and then it really boiled down to whether or not the vice presidents and higher ups and the legal people could hammer out something to make it work. It becomes less creative at that point. So it was not something we could just say, we're going to do it, and then they let us do it. It was something that was like, a lot of people had to sign off on that, and that doesn't add up to much for forever. You know, you haven't seen Access ever again since then.
No, you haven't. It's been a while.
Not worth even calling each other. He also, honestly, he wasn't the most popular character that we ever made up either. So it's a man back either. We could have maybe built him into something, but it was a good try, but obviously not as good as the whole initial coming up with. It was just an excuse to get more Amalgam Comics out there, honestly.
Fair enough. Which makes sense, because, I mean, it did hit with a splash, especially that first wave. I'm curious, in Marvel... go ahead.
The more you do things, the less unique they are. You know, the first thing was a surprise, and then when you do it again, it's like, oh, this is the thing again, I guess. You know? It's just not... The energy is not the same. As far as the enthusiasm of the paying customer, you know, it's just not it's not the same because it's not fresh, you know. So there's a diminishing return. You go to the well too often.
True. Another of the matchups I wanted to ask about, just because I feel like this one often gets kind of not made fun of, that's the wrong word, but you have Aquaman taking out Namor by dropping a whale on him. And I feel like Namor fans do not like that. What is your take on that?
Well, that, the rest of the fights, we had to just agree to an even amount between the companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think Namor lost the vote on that one just because we needed to have it be a certain number of wins for each company on the ones that the people weren't voting on. And, you know, for my money, you know, I think that Namor would have won that fight. But if Aquaman is Jason Momoa, I don't think so.
Interesting.
Aquaman back then would not have won that fight in a real-world fight. Mm-hmm. But if Jason Momoa is Aquaman, I think that it would have been, Namor would have been in more trouble, that's for sure.
Now, given that Marvel versus DC and Amalgam were obviously, you know, you're and Mark's kind of babies, how involved or were you involved in the other kind of special projects that came out of it, like the trading cards and that kind of stuff?
We were pretty involved in the trading cards and stuff at that time. I know when I did the Death of Superman stuff, I was basically the editor of the trading cards. We did come up with, we were so successful that they hired a guy to be the trading card editor, do future stuff. So they worked on these Amalgam cards, but I would always look at them and pass at them. And I'm sure Marvel had, they had a trading card company involved in their whole existence, I think, at that time.
Oh, for sure. So,
yeah, so they definitely involved in that stuff, you know. But it was all based on what was in the comics, so it wasn't that hard to just follow along.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I recently finally got a complete set of those cards, and I was kind of reading through them, and yeah, I mean, they're pretty faithful to, for the most part, although it comes that they come up with some of their own lore as well, so I was just kind of curious what that process was like for them to be working on those cards.
Yeah, basically, whatever was made up for the cards, it still was run past us, and we had a chance to argue about it or fight about it if we wanted to, but it also, ultimately, it wasn't going to affect a lot of things because the comics were going to be gone in a week.
Mm-hmm.
So that it wasn't worth our time to get into fighting over, you know, the continuity or what, you know. A lot of fights that happen in comic books are based on, this is a good idea, but we don't want to have to live with this forever.
Mm.
You know, the bright idea is we don't want to have this be there forever. So that's less of a problem when you're talking about 1 or 2 weeks of comics. They're not really forever problems at that point.
Got it. Now, I'm curious. So, I mean, you guys obviously knew it was big enough splash that, you know, trade paperbacks obviously were not as common or as ubiquitous as they are now, but you guys still put out trade paperbacks in the, you know, right around when these, when the miniseries and the Amalgam books first came out, you were already putting these out, these collected editions. So did you guys already have a pretty good sense that they would do well on a bookshelf?
Yeah, we thought it would be okay, but it's kind of like, is it the kind of trade paperback that would sell well at, Barnes & Noble? Mm. Probably not. They're not that well-known characters. In fact, they're not known at all because they were non-existent before that day.
But they look enough like them, right? Like, and I guess that was always part of the appeal for people who didn't know, which, again, me as a kid, I didn't know what was going on. So I was like, oh, man, that guy's like Wolverine and Batman put together. Because he is.
Yeah.
That's the fun, right?
As long as the comics were there for a few years, you know, people who missed the event could actually catch up on it. Mm. Or people who made some issues in it could have it all in one place. It's easier to keep track of, the square bound trade paperback than it is your loose floppies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that there was an appeal to it, but then there was a limited life to that kind of thing, which is unfortunately why I think when they go out of print, they become a little more harder to find, but more valuable too. They I don't know what those things go for on eBay these days.
They're a pretty penny. Usually at least $100 a volume, if not more.
Wow. And I can't even tell you if I have copies around here.
I mean, you have a lifetime of ephemera that's built up, right?
Well, I have a lot of stuff. I mean, I did get rid of a lot of stuff before I moved to California. But now I'm going to be starting to hit my purge age, so I'm going to be going through a lot of stuff, and I'll find things. I still have boxes in my garage that we didn't unpack since we got here.
Oh, wow.
And that was 30 years ago.
Well, I mean, if you come up with Amalgam Comics collections, let me know. I'll take them off your hands.
Well, you might have to get them off of eBay because I want $100.
That's the most honest response I've ever heard. I really appreciated that.
I'll sell you them for whatever they're going on eBay.
That's fair. Well, only if you sign it.
Well, I have a wife that is going to need to be provided for the rest of her life when I'm dead.
Okay. She'll need that Amalgam Comics money.
Yes. Well, I'm going to start signing every book I have here so that she has something to sell later.
As you said, it maybe didn't do enough of what the higher-ups wanted Marvel versus DC to do in terms of kind of saving the industry, but do you think it succeeded where it was meant to? I mean, I guess really what you and Mark wanted was to put out some fun comics, and I think on that end, you definitely succeeded.
Yeah. Well, I think it succeeded as far as us having fun and the readers having fun. I do think it succeeded in bumping our sales for a little 5 minutes, but again, it was kind of not built to build up sales for next week's Batman books or next week's Superman books or next week's Spider-Man books. It wasn't something that was meant to stick for the rest of the line. It was more to get people into a comic shop who hadn't come into a comic shop in a few years. And to maybe say, oh, I'll get this Marvel versus DC, but oh, look at this comic over here, and I'll get that too. You know, so that, I think it did a little bit towards that. At the same time, I think that, you know, there is a point where people, they get overloaded, they get disappointed. You know, I keep hearing that, you know, Death of Superman was one of the things that ruined the comic business, and I'm like, no, not really. People who thought that buying one comic was going to put their kids through college kind of ruined the business, because that is just foolish. Mm-hmm. Because if you know what makes a comic book valuable, it's scarcity, not a million copies in everybody's house being protected by Mylar Snuggies. It was just a bizarre thing. And then there became this resentment towards this collectible thing. I mean, you know, and stuff like the Death of Superman, that was a phenomenon that people accused us of just doing it for the hype. And I'm like, first of all, our job is to sell comics, so we're happy to sell comics.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we did press conferences for Marvel versus DC. We did all kinds of interviews. We pushed that. We both marketing departments were on top of that. But if people don't want to buy something, they just won't. Mm. You can't force people to care about things. And again, maybe Marvel and DC had done so many crossovers by that point that it was old news to a degree. Mm. So, you know, we couldn't make it big just because we wanted to make it big. You have to be honest with yourself about that kind of stuff. Mm. So, as creators, we succeeded in creating something that had never been done before, and we thought that was a good thing. Mm. So, we were happy with it. Mark was so happy, he said, I can't come up with anything better than this. I want to leave the planet. And he left.
Oh.
But, you know, it's like And you can't top that. We never topped that. I never topped Death of Superman. I never topped the Amalgam stuff. Mm. And both of them were things I knew I was going to be talking about for the rest of my life, and that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these podcasts and radio shows and all this stuff, and it's like, that's what they're talking about. Nobody's calling me about my pages in Crazy Magazine.
I mean, next time.
Nah, there's not a lot to talk about there. There's not a lot. Well, they're cheaper, though, on eBay than Amalgam Comics.
Apparently. one of my final questions about DC versus Marvel. One thing I always thought was interesting, and I'm curious what kind of, you know, coin toss had to occur, was that DC got to technically publish issues 1 and 4, which would arguably be the ones that would have the highest sales. So I'm just curious how that kind of came about.
I don't really remember how that came about. I don't think the last issues of things sell more than the second and third issues, personally.
Hmm.
I'm not really sure. I do think that in this case, because that had the results of the voting, that might have been a higher sell. I don't really remember how that came about.
Hmm. I've always wondered, because it's been interesting. Like, you would think that they would alternate issues, like, you know, 1 and 3 and 2 and 4, as opposed to Marvel publishing 2 and 3 and then DC publishing the other two.
Honestly, it's been so long. If you would have told me that's how we did it, I would have said, "Yep." You know, I don't remember how we did it or why we did it. I don't remember if it was a marketing thing or if it was just something that somebody insisted on, or the project would go away. But I don't think there was any kind of things like that going on. I just think that, you know, in the DC also, you know, wasn't. You know, DC was the company that was doing more trade paperbacks and having more success with them. So we did the trade paperbacks.
Hmm.
You know, I had to put them together, you know, design-wise and all that kind of stuff. You know, so it was just like maybe a concession to the fact that DC had that part of their gig down better than Marvel at the time.
Hmm. Was every printing of the trade paperback by DC? I don't think I knew that part.
I don't know if it was by DC. I think Marvel was still the publisher, but it was put together by our people, you know, pretty much, so that they would match. We wanted them to look similar and have the same design and that kind of stuff.
That's true. I mean, it definitely has more of a... It doesn't have a Marvel aesthetic at the time in terms of what their trade paperbacks usually look like, but you're right. When you look at, you know, the first Amalgam Wave... The DC Comics collection trade paperback of it does kind of match the spine of the Marvel versus DC spine as well. So that makes sense, actually, when you say it. When I look at them next to each other, I'm like, okay, I can see it's the same design aesthetic.
Yeah, so it was like we did the work for Marvel at that point, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that was just smart, you know, so that it wouldn't be something that was out there with conflicting looks and messages. So, and we really were united to try to make this thing look like we were a team-up of Marvel and DC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, weren't looking to have it look messy.
It's an interesting...
Ultimately, except for what the readers voted on, we didn't even want to have a winner or a loser. We wanted everybody to share in this.
It's definitely it's a fun artifact of its time, because again, it's the characters, you know, at a very interesting spot in their careers. I think Spider-Man has always been the most interesting one to me, because he's wearing the Ben Reilly suit. He calls himself Ben Reilly, but also Peter Parker, but he has the Peter Parker hair, and I've always been confused by that. But I'm like, well, they had to try and make him as recognizable as possible, given that he was in the middle of his own clone saga at the time, which I guess Dan in and around this period would have been working on Spider-Man as well, because I know he wrote the first, what, 6 issues of Sensational Spider-Man with Ben Reilly in that costume, which he has in this particular miniseries. So Spider-Man's probably at the weirdest spot in his career.
It's true. It was definitely, maybe it was hard for everybody to decide on that, but as far as DC was concerned, we didn't care what they did. We just wanted whatever Marvel wanted for that character, for their character. So it was that worked out good, and it was just great timing because we had just come up with Superboy 2 years before this. So it was kind of good to have a kind of a counterpart that fit nicely for Algum.
Did you, I mean, given that you were the Superman editor at the time, I mean, I guess you were more, what's the word, protective about how Superman would have been, you know, kind of drawn and illustrated throughout the story?
Sure. I mean, I always worried about Superman, but I wasn't the editor of the Super Soldier comic. So, if that wasn't Superman.
True.
You know, I read it, and I approved it, but I didn't, you know, obsess about it because it wasn't Superman. But if it was the real Superman, I would have had a bigger opinion about it for sure.
Did you have an opinion about Superboy losing to Spider-Man?
Not really. Again, we had to just be, you know, fair that both companies had an equal amount of winners and losers. That wasn't one of the ones that people voted on, was it?
I don't think so. I'd have to find the voting card somewhere. I don't actually have a copy myself.
And me neither. And if it was the one that people voted on, Spider-Man is the more popular character.
True.
You know, Ben Reilly, they don't know what Ben Reilly is, but they know what Spider-Man is. Mm-hmm. And Superboy, they may have heard that Clark Kent was Superboy in Smallville, but it's just he's not as big a deal as Spider-Man. Spider-Man's a huge character.
True.
And that's what I say. It's like the voting part of this was definitely a popularity contest. That was it was the characters who won were the characters who sold more. Not logically the stronger or more efficient characters in each area. You know, would Batman beat Captain America? I don't know. I don't know. It's a tough one. It's a toughie.
When you guys picked like the voting matchups, did you kind of know then before you kind of put it out into the world where it was probably going to go then?
Yeah, we had a sense, you know, but there was a point where we had to just let it be what it was. And obviously I hoped that DC would win, but, you know, we're coming off of, at that point, even 30 years of Marvel, you know, kind of coming up on DC and becoming more popular than DC. So I was realistic about it.
Any final thoughts you can share with me about either DC versus Marvel or Amalgam?
No, I shared the best stuff with you. The Dinosaur's Mansion and the fact that people call it Amalgam. Those are my best bon mots about this project.
Oh, I do have one other follow-up, and I guess this is probably something that ended up happening by the actual editors of each book. But obviously, each Amalgam book did have, you know, fun letter columns that were, you know, just kind of written about nothing, right? About books that didn't happen and lore that didn't occur. Were you involved in those as well, or did you just kind of let the editors do what they wanted to do?
Let the editors do them, and they all had fun with it. You know, obviously, again, I would look at them and read them, but again, it was like kind of it wasn't going to affect the future much, so I wasn't going to be too picky about them. So as long as everybody was having fun and if the energy and the fun was coming through, I didn't care what they did. It was definitely a fun project. I mean, I guess the most fun thing for me in the end of it all was that M.M. Carwall got nominated for an Eisner Award.
No way.
And, oh, yes. He did not win.
Who did he lose to?
I was there to represent in case he did win, and he did not win. I would have loved for M.M. Carwall to have won. But he just stayed for March date.
Mm-hmm. Do you know who won instead?
I don't remember, honestly.
I'll have to look that up.
Whoever won. And now they don't even do Best Editor Awards at the Eisner, so I think we kind of ruined it for everybody.
Fair enough. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today and to go down memory lane and talk about Amalgam and Marvel versus DC. I don't know if you often get asked as much about this stuff, but I really appreciate you taking the time.
No, it comes up. It's definitely something I like talking about. I like people remembering Mark's involvement. I'm glad that Tom had talked to you about it. You know, it's like it was a fun thing. It was a product of its time, and you know, I would love for stuff like that to be as fun in comics again. I think that would be good for the business.
For sure.
And you know, because they call them funny books for a while. It's like this. I don't feel the fun. But that, and I don't want to be the crabby old guy saying it's not like it used to be, and these kids today, and all that kind of stuff. It just seems to be a different kind of vibe going on, and different is not always bad. But we had some things going for us back in the 80s and 90s where there was an energy. You know, that's where you got the Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen and John Byrne's Superman. And even the X-Men, it was just like X-Men, you couldn't stop the X-Men. They were just going up and up and up and up. Then Bitch came along and, you know, rejuvenated everybody too. It's like there was a lot of positive energy going on.
For sure.
And I would love for that to be happening again.
Absolutely.
The kids need to make that happen.
That's right. Okay. Well, thank you again for taking the time today. And don't worry, I will be hitting you up for more conversations at some point in the future. Maybe not to talk about Crazy, but definitely to talk about something else.
Sounds good. I'm here. I have no job now, but that's okay. My job now is to go to doctors, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, you take care.
Have a good one, and Happy New Year, and all that jazz.